this latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast, hosted by Data Protection People. My name is Ollie Rea, and I am joined once again, properly this time, he's not off skiving somewhere else in the building, is Mr. Dave Holmes. Hello, Dave.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm all right, mate. How are you?
I'd like to confess as to whether I was skiving or not last week, and I was. So I have to apologise.
For those of you who weren't with us last week or haven't had a chance to catch up yet, the intention, because myself, Dave and Phil were going to be in our HQ in Leeds, was to do one the three of us sat around the table. Now, in the end, you'll see the video because the video is up and available, that only myself and Phil were around the table. Although you did stop by at one point to wave at us through a window and just be a general distraction instead of actually contributing, but
no, for sure. But it was far too late for me to join in. It was getting towards the end. I do apologise for missing. I was on urgent client needs that kind of got in the way. But I was looking forward to joining and taking part. But maybe next time.
That's all right. Don't you worry. But it's nice to have you back with us this week. And this week was a popular session. And I mean, the reason we did this was because a year ago, almost to the day, we did our previous session on DPIAs, and it's one of our most popular sessions ever. So we thought we'd repeat the trick, or at least attempt to. And well, I think it went down pretty well, didn't it, Dave?
I really enjoyed it, and I don't know whether that's just because I missed last week, and I do like to chat about things. But I really enjoyed it. There was so much to talk about, and I feel there's potential for maybe a third one in the offing, only purely because I don't think we got through half as much stuff that we could have. And it was, we covered a lot of material, but there's I've still got a load of lists and a load of notes that I could have continued and kind of pulled apart a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. There's plenty of interesting topics in there. We spent quite a lot of time talking about privacy tech, actually, and we spoke about this last week as well. So there's going to be a session at some point we'll schedule on privacy tech in and of its own right, because we think that's a valuable thing to discuss. So keep your eyes peeled for that, listeners. But yeah, plenty of interesting conversations. I don't want to say too much because it will inevitably spoil the content of the session.
No, for sure. But what I can say is a bit of a tease is the fact that we did look at tried to get involved with, is there a difference to be had between a DPIA and a PIA, for example?
Yes.
And whether is anybody actually completing a DPIA properly?
Dave enjoys stirring the pot, as regular listeners won't know.
But that's all covered.
Yes, it is all covered. And we almost got drawn into quite a lengthy conversation about the use of biometrics. So if you're interested in that, do go and have a listen. Before we leave you, a couple bits in terms of what we're up to over the coming weeks. We're back next week with an episode of GDPR Radio, as ever, on alternating weeks. So if there's anything that we've not discussed today you'd like us to pick up, then do come along and let us know, or DM us on any of the social media platforms, etc., with any suggestions or topics you'd like to see covered. And then we will be back the week after that with, I believe on the session I billed it as our PCI DSS session, but I'm actually mistaken. That's not entirely correct, and I do apologize. So the week after that, the 19th, is going to be our session specifically for the finance sector about contracts and complex processing relationships. But if you're not in finance, I sincerely encourage you to come anyway, because there will be plenty of shared learning there, lots of things which will be more broadly applicable. I think it's going to be really interesting. But don't fret, if you are interested in PCI DSS, that session is still very much coming up. We're going to be talking about version 4 and all the changes, how to prepare for it. That's going to be in September the 16th specifically. So mark up your diaries if you're interested in the payment card industry data security standard version 4. Now I can take a breath. Dave, anything before we let the listeners go?
No, I think we'll just let them jump straight in. There's a lot of stuff to cover, some really interesting points to discuss. And if there's anything you left unanswered and any questions you want, do please fire them across.
Yep, absolutely. Couldn't agree with you more. Dave, thanks for your time and your contributions. And listeners, we'll let you get stuck into this latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. Without further ado, we'll do a little bit of news before we get stuck into DPIAs, Dave, if that's all right. I don't know if you've got anything.
I was going to say that is fine, but I do apologise. I'll have to. I've not kept up so much with the news this week. So I've made some comments. You might have to discuss a couple of them, and then I'll have to do a bit of thinking on my feet.
Okay, no worries. It's nice to see you're as prepared as ever for this. Well, it'll be a relatively short segment because I've only got a couple of bits, but obviously those of you who are here with us live, if you want to lob anything in the chat, then please do. As you know, we keep an eye on that. I've only got a couple bits for you, Dave, one of which I found quite amusing, to be honest. The headline caught my attention, which is that I think it might have been earlier this week or last week, the UK Parliament had opened its very own TikTok account. Why our Parliament needs a TikTok account, I'm not entirely sure, but you'll be pleased to know that it was instantly closed down over data security and processing fears, because obviously it's Chinese owned and operated.
To be fair, I think you know I get riled quite easily about politics. I think you're trying to drag me into the politics of it all, as opposed to.
I'm really not. I'm really not. Listen.
So being cynical, being absolutely cynical, you've got a government that believes that the data reforms, in their opinion, to the right direction. Yet it's the same kind of government that thinks we'll have a TikTok account because they don't realise it's run from China.
Well, if I'm being a real stickler, it's not quite the government, it is Parliament. But yes, essentially.
The same boat, isn't it? Just different parts of the same boat.
Yeah, exactly. I just thought that was quite amusing and worth raising. No real insights, but it's just
a bit of a chuckle, though.
So,
A bit of a chuckle.
A bit of a chuckle, exactly. On a slightly less.
Do you think it was something when they say Parliament? I've not read it, but do you think it's something that the bun fight between Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss are trying to engage with the wider electorate through using social media?
With younger voters, yeah, quite possibly. Quite possibly. This is where we need Zara to come on and tell us all about TikTok. She knows about that, whereas, unfortunately, I do not.
I don't partake in TikTok either, so I'm happy to move on when you have on this one. It's some
quite amusing bits from those with us live. Michael saying it is, after all, an app for fools to mess about on camera, so fair enough. And Janice pointing out that they've obviously not done their DPIA, Dave. There you go.
Thank you for the link. Yeah, no, thank you for the link.
Exactly. Alison's saying, what do people think about using Zoom? Is that appropriate for businesses to use? I think, I'll tell you what, if it's okay, Alison, we'll come back to that in a little bit, because that probably links in quite nicely to our main topic. Before we get to that, a couple of other bits. I wanted to point out an article that I had read this week, which I thought was really interesting, Dave. And because we mentioned, so you weren't with us last week, but one of the things we talked about, you are aware of, was an employment tribunal judgment in this country, which ruled that vegetarianism is not, in fact, a protected characteristic under the Equality Act.
Yes.
However, veganism probably is. And that's quite interesting for us, obviously, from a special category point of view, because then do we consider it to be a religious or philosophical belief, in which case, obviously, it's a protected characteristic and you need an Article 9 basis. Well, to follow up on that, I read some quite interesting commentary from a peer in the field this week who brought to us a piece of enforcement action, I believe, out of Lithuania, unless I'm mistaken. And effectively, one of the things that comes out of this is that a Lithuanian council, maybe, I think, or local government, possibly, I may be saying that wrong. No, the government themselves basically published a list of personal data relating to civil servants who'd received public funds. Now, in and of itself, you might not necessarily think that that's anything too serious. You might think that's something that potentially you would get from a FOIA perspective in this country even. But what was interesting there, apparently, is they didn't just publish the details of those civil servants, but also details of the civil servants' spouses, cohabitees, or partners. Wow. And basically, this commentary is about at what point does inference about an individual's situation become Article 9 data? Because if you've got details of someone who is cohabiting with someone else, you know, does that necessarily indicate their sexual orientation or their marital status? Now, obviously, marital status is not technically a protected characteristic, whereas the former obviously is. But it's a really interesting conversation to have, at which point I think where the line in the sand is over.
I think possibly if I'm summing up what you kind of said correctly there, is if it's a known special characteristic because it's been declared somewhere that whatever you've indicated as. But is it, if it's inferred, that's obviously somebody's opinion, and opinions are still personal data because it doesn't necessarily whether opinions are correct or not for it to be personal data. But it's an inferred, if it's an inferred opinion about somebody's special characteristics in that sense, so you're inferring from some information that they might have a particular sexual orientation, that kind of thing, would that then still make it special category data? And would that then need a special, an Article 9 condition?
Yeah, that's the essence of it. So if you knew, for instance, that you had two men cohabiting together, that doesn't necessarily mean anything. Does it mean something if one of them has previously donated to a pro-LGBTQ plus charity? Well, not necessarily, but already you could start to make inferences, you know. And it's an interesting conversation, you know, where is the line? I mean, some of it will purely be speculation. Some of it, you know, maybe more founded, but it certainly highlights just how much of a grey area these types of things can be.
I certainly have to kick that one around. It's really interesting kind of point as a whether inferred data would be special category data, but I guess it's dependent what you're doing with that inference. Are you just doing it as, well, we've just inferred it and we're doing nothing with it, or are you processing, treating them differently because of that inference?
Yeah, no, it's interesting. Oh, Joe seems to have locked his laptop by accident, so we're now treated to a lovely picture of some capybaras.
There's me thinking it's his family, but maybe you are right. It looks like capybaras.
Steady on, Dave.
no, just fine. I'm only joking.
Interesting comment from Lawrence. Lawrence says, I thought marital status was a protected characteristic since there was a case I recall from my training about 15 years ago where in a high court case ruled that to call someone Mrs. was to infer a sexual relationship. In that sexual relationship was inferred from marriage. I did not have the link to the case, and I would need to see if I can chase up the name of the trainer to check the high court case, which was not a DPA issue. Oh, someone just put another comment, so I've lost it. Which was not a DPA issue as such. I think it was something to do with the divorce case. But that is interesting. I mean, we've often kicked this around, just to clarify my previous comments. We've often kicked this around. Is marital status a... So again, this is where it's worth differentiating, because when we talk about protected characteristic, that has a very specific meaning in under the Equality Act, right? But we're talking about it more in terms of an Article 9 special category data context, although the two will significantly overlap. And we've often talked about this, haven't we, whether marital status could be deemed to be a protected characteristic, but I suppose not. My reading anyway is that if you take a layman's reading of Article 9, it wouldn't be caught, but it's still a real grey area. I think that's fair to say.
I would agree. The bit we were looking at is, like I say, a kind of a strict interpretation of what's required for Article 9. And if you took a strict interpretation of that, I don't think marital status would come up, because it's only looking at sexual orientation, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. And this is where it's really interesting. So Debbie follows up saying, you know, believe it's against the law to discriminate against anyone because of, and then a series of characteristics, including being married or in a single partnership. And again, this is where it's particularly interesting, because Lawrence makes a good point. Again, it's sexual orientation or sex life. But again, can you naturally make that inference? You know, not to get too graphic about it, but I'm sure you can all appreciate that that aspect of your life isn't necessarily immediately tied to your marital status from a legal perspective.
No,
so
for sure. And whilst you're talking, I've just actually Googled types of discrimination. Well, just Googled not types of discrimination. I just Googled what is your protected characteristics, and the Gov site on discrimination, your rights, says protected characteristics are age, gender reassignment, being married or in a civil partnership, being pregnant or on maternity leave, disability, race including colour, nationality, ethnic or national origin, religion or belief, sex or sexual orientation. So they're probably a little bit more detailed than what you'd find in the special category data.
Yeah, which is why I think it's interesting. But I feel like we're at risk of talking about this for the entire hour because it's it's really fascinating. I mean, listen, all those who are with us here, if you, I think broadly we're along the same lines. But if you want to keep pushing me on that, then please do by all means. I had a couple other bits, just the one actually, Dave, which I thought, again, I don't have too much to input on, but I thought it was worth raising. I quickly did a tour of the ICO website this morning to see if there was anything, and they were reposting a story about a former health advisor who's been found guilty of illegally accessing patient records, and apparently this was all people that he knew in some capacity, and he accessed the records without the knowledge of the trust, or, you know, any type of permission or any knowledge from the patients themselves. I think it's about 14 patients he accessed their records. I'm not sure. The story doesn't seem to say that he did anything with that, but still accessed them. And presumably that's what the logs show. He's been found guilty of that and asked to pay £250 to each of the patients. So that's about £3,000, which, you know, this is what I always find a little bit confusing around some of this, is that in theory, that's a really, really low, you know, that's a really sort of light punishment in theory, because if you're technically going down that line, wouldn't you be able to do them under the Computer Misuse Act for that sort of thing?
Was he found guilty under the Computer Misuse Act then, or was it under the DPA, did it say?
And this is where I should have read the article properly.
But it's interesting. I mean, it's only one person, 14 patients, but it would indicate, I know we're going to move on to DPIAs. I know we've possibly got a question there as well around privacy impact assessments. But would that then, just on the face of it, indicate that their privacy is only worth £250 for patient records?
Now you're stirring the pot, Dave. just to clarify, it was under Section 170 of the 18 Data Protection Act.
Right, because we normally see computer misuse, don't we? We've often, I know it's far too much to get into this one, maybe we'll look at it in another one, but we've often talked about whether it's easier to find a conviction under the DPA 18 for this kind of thing, or whether the case law around Computer Misuse Act is sufficient enough and more determinative enough at this point, and that's why the Computer Misuse Act is used. I know we've had discussions around that, but it's interesting if it was under the DPA 18 for sure.
It is interesting. Section 170, as far as I am aware, is knowingly or recklessly obtaining data without the permission of the controller, right? Isn't that the same sort of thing that's at the heart of a lot of the Andrew Skelton stuff, or am I conflating the two?
Possibly. Yeah, possibly
conflating, but anyway, it's interesting and possibly want to revisit when we've had a proper time to think about it. You keep trying to segue into DPIA, so I tell you what, I'm gonna let you do that. Now, for those of you who are slightly newer to this feed, you may not know that actually this is a part two, technically, this episode, because almost a year ago today, we had our first session on DPIAs. That's still available across all listening platforms, so you can go back and find that, and I'm sure Miles will be able to share a link to it, if not I've got it right here, if that's helpful. But yeah, this is the follow-up. But last time you weren't with us, Dave, for whatever reason that might have been. So to kick us off, what are some of the things at a high level, if you give us a flavour of the types of things that you want to cover today? I mean, obviously, we've spoken about off air, so I already know, but
for sure.
For so a bit just of exposition.
Just a couple of things. Firstly, are we doing data protection impact assessments correctly? And are we doing them and using them in the right way in that sense? And we'll come back to that one shortly. Then I thought it was quite interesting because you still read stuff prior to the GDPR coming in, and even the ICO guidance all indicated privacy impact assessments, not data protection impact assessments. The DPIAs were something that came in with the GDPR. So therefore, is there a difference between a DPIA or a data protection impact assessment and a privacy impact assessment. So I thought that would be quite a nice one to kind of kick around and have a kind of a little look at, in essence. And then reflecting on whether people do, whether people don't, or any good examples of where potentially DPIAs have been used in order to give effect to data protection by design and by default, which, as we know, is kind of more of a concept than a tangible thing in that sense. So those were some of the areas I was hoping to kind of have a look at and to kind of discuss in this session.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, that sounds good. We'll get into that in just a second. I have popped the link to the first session in the chat. You'll have to forgive me. I've shared the Spotify link specifically just because it's my preferred platform. I'm not sponsored. It's just because I had it open. Do you know what's, just quickly as a side note, what is absolutely incredible, that was episode 35 and we are now up to how many miles? I mean, more than double that. We're up to about 80 odd, I think, now, if not getting on for 90. So just quickly say thank you all very much for continuing to support us. That is quite a stark reminder. So Dave, do you want to start anywhere in particular with this one? I mean, one of the things that I wanted to talk about, actually, just quickly, for those of you who were with us last week, Phil and I touched on privacy tech briefly. So whether it's, you know, OneTrust being one of the most famous ones, but there's all sorts out there. DP Organizer, we've even developed some of our own internally. You know, there's loads, but one, we did touch on it and we will do a full session on it at some point because we think it's potentially quite interesting. But obviously one of the key aspects of that type of tech is that in theory, it automates a huge amount of the work associated with privacy monitoring, you know, compliance. And one of those things, of course, is going to be DPIs. And I thought it was just worth touching on that. I mean, I don't know what your experience with this type of tech, particularly in this context, is like, Dave. I mean, I've recently finished doing a bunch of DPIs on OneTrust, so it's sort of quite fresh in my mind. But yeah, I don't know if you, to start us off, have got any insights.
Yeah, I've used some of the platforms, and I think they're pretty good. I'm not saying they're without their issues, but I think they're pretty good. And if I could get to kind of a perfect, I should have been a developer and I should have been doing this years ago, really, but I just can't do computer code, which is why I don't do it. But what I like about the PrivTech side of things is if you get it right, you can make it multi-relational and you can give it a bit of 3D depth to it. And to kind of explain that, if you're completing a DPIA for new process activity, then it would automatically populate the ROPA if you've got the details in there. You know what I mean? If the DPIA is looking at assessing a bit of software and the software is provided by a third party, that it would link through to a process and agreement and any due diligence. So you get kind of that 360 look at it, whereas when you're trying to use template formats, and we can discuss those shortly. When you're using template formats, it's pretty just one dimensional, and everything else you then got to go hunting for, or looking for where there's a register that contains those links or those directions where you can find the information. But when it's on a PrivTech platform, it's there. You can kind of go, I'm looking at this risk assessment. I need to see the data processing agreement, and it can show that it's done. You can show that the action's been taken through and populated on a ROPA and that kind of stuff. And that's, if you can get to that point with PrivTech, and you might be able to, I've not used it recently in that sense, but if you could get, so it's that three dimensional and all linked as I've just discussed, then I think that would be quite powerful instead of it being kind of separated through different templates and logs and reporting forms and filing structures and things.
Sure. I mean, from my perspective, I am a little bit on the fence about it all, to be perfectly, straight with you all. I think there are real benefits to it, clearly. You know, it can alleviate a huge amount of the burdens associated with completing a lot of this, particularly administrative ones. As you say, Dave, you've got that real sort of like 3D model to it, and it integrates well between your records processing activities, your risk assessments, your risk monitoring. You know, you can link it to records of suppliers, etc. Like, in theory, it's fantastic. I think one of my slight concerns is that obviously we're only human, and a lot of the time the systems will only be as good as the person who's calibrated them. Mm-hmm. And even though they can be incredibly knowledgeable and calibrated it really well, what we are often blind to is our sort of small biases in terms of the way that we see things. And you know, if we don't necessarily share the exact same understanding about how to go through that process and what we're looking for, then that can potentially be problematic. So it requires someone with a real sort of ability to stand back and look at the whole thing. But I do think there is clear value. My last point on it, and this is something that I know you want to come to a little bit more, but one of the things that from my perspective is that really the DPIA in and of itself, in terms of format, is something which I think anyway, in terms of how I read the law, is extremely flexible. Because as we know, the GDPR isn't very prescriptive. You know, it's far more loose in terms of that, not a framework. So that can be both a blessing and a curse. And I think that is potentially really highlighted through PrivTech, which is that on the one hand, you know, for those who maybe aren't as experienced and maybe need more support in completing these types of risk assessments, the PrivTech tools can be really great in terms of really sort of teasing the information out of them, holding their hand through the process, being quite granular. But on the other hand, if you're like you and I and everyone here in attendance and everyone listening, presumably, who has got a bit more experience with that and maybe doesn't need quite as much handholding, it can kind of hamper you. And there's nothing more frustrating than being asked, you know, a variant of the same question twice because you answered it the first time around.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I would certainly support that. I'll always say that PrivTech's got its place with what I indicated earlier. I'm not sure whether it's fully there yet. If anybody's aware of any platforms that you feel is fully there, then I'm more than happy to have a little look. But I'm not sure if it's fully there yet. And it comes back to a couple of bits for me. One is the user interface and how you present the information to individuals, whether that's actually on PrivTech or offline. If you're going to make it complicated, hard to understand, then you're just going to be putting people off. And if you've got a culture that's maybe not positive towards data protection or compliance generally, then it still isn't going to be completed. You're going to get people kind of looking at it and going, well, I don't know what I'm going to be doing in that kind of sense, or it is too technical, or it's too off-putting because they just don't generally understand it. And then kind of on that, and the point you were just kind of making was when you come into looking at DPIAs and things, and I know we have with some of our clients where you look at what they're trying to assess, and you're kind of thinking, well, the template really doesn't do it any justice as a form of assessment. You're going to have to step outside the template, because if we're not careful, the template will just lead you to answering the questions that are on the template as opposed to necessarily thinking wider and thinking about other elements that you maybe need to pull into a risk assessment. So I think sometimes, whether it's in PrivTech, whether it's in template form, we need to be mindful of the fact that, is this the right format for doing a DPIA, and not necessarily to be afraid of stepping outside of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a couple of things there that I'd like to touch on in a little more detail. So I'll come back to the point about scope in just a second, because I think one of the things that you're always talking about generally, even outside of DPIAs, but is the concept of what are you trying to achieve through this? I'd like to touch on that in a second, because I know that's something that's big for you. But also, just to come back, you're talking a lot about format, aren't you? You're talking a lot about potentially the standardized form that a lot of us have dealt with at one point in our lives, and potentially some of the issues around that. Do you want to sort of tell us what really your issue is there and where it stems from?
Yeah, and again, I'm more than happy to be challenged on it. It's just my interpretation of it. But taking away the issue that I've just said about template form, a template form is just a template form. You can, and there's been some very good versions. And I think we were talking earlier about, I think one of our earlier versions had kind of sprung from the European Data Protection Board's kind of set up on DPIAs, I think we were talking about. But in essence, if you look at in the technical sense, the DPIA is for high risk processing in that sense, under was it Article 35, I think it is, of the GDPR. So what you generally then have is a template document that is solely focused on addressing Article 35, which is, are you high risk processing or not, in that kind of sense. So then you've got this kind of template document that looks at stage one, stage two. And stage one's a range of questions, and that generally the form kind of says, if you answer no to all these questions, you don't need to progress in that sense. And just before I come back to answering that kind of point, what I've often found with some of our clients is the fact that they will complete stage one, have a range of nose, and it says you don't need to go any further. And you go, well, we've completed what we need to complete. We don't need to do anything else. But the point that I seem to think sometimes when they're possibly being misused is the fact that stage one is just helping you identify whether the activity is high risk or not. In that sense, stage one is not the risk assessment. Stage, by answering no's to a range of questions on stage one, it doesn't say that, it doesn't identify that what you're assessing is actually risk-free. It just says it's not high-risk processing. So when you look at what the law says around the GDPR around high-risk processing, it kind of says if you're doing high-risk processing, you need to do a DPIA. However, you are expected to still understand the risks within your processing activities. So that would then lead you to think, well, we've got a DPIA possibly for high-risk and then some other form of risk assessment if it's not high-risk in that sense. So we're coming back to the client's point now. So generally what I find is clients can, or some of our clients kind of say, well, we do a DPIA for everything because partly we need to do them for high-risk areas, partly it's best practice to do them anyway. And in essence, if we've understood the law well enough, we're going to have to do some form of risk assessment. So then they do the DPIA, but they still read step one, as I've answered the range of no's, I don't need to go any further. And it's that kind of bringing it back, that kind of bit that I get stuck with. Whereas if you're doing a DPIA because it's best practice, and that's fine, or you're doing some form of risk assessment because you think it's valuable, that's fine. But we need to understand that stage one is not the risk assessment. So if you stop at stage one, you've not assessed the risks, you've not identified the risks, you've not mitigated any risks, you've not even considered anything around the compliance element of it, if there's third-party suppliers that you maybe need to assess, or there's other mitigating actions around role-based access controls or anything else that may come up through the risk assessment. You just see stage one done, it says I can stop because I've answered no, and that's it. And that's kind of the crux of the issues that I have with stage one and stage two. So what I'd like to kind of see is the fact that that element in stage one, if you're going to use DPIAs as a general tool to do general risk assessments, that's absolutely fine. But remove the bit that says stop here if you answer a range of no's, because otherwise it doesn't necessarily work with the setup that you've got. And that's kind of the crux. I hope that kind of made sense. Kind of makes sense in my head. I hope it kind of made sense to everybody else who's listening, and possibly you can verbalise that, Ollie, if you like to.
Well, I'm just glad, Dave, that you got that off your chest, because it's it's obvious to me that that's been bothering you for a while now. Yeah. I mean, you know, I completely understand where you're coming from. One of the key things from me, one of the things I do find particularly difficult if you are working with within a setup such as you've described there, is if you're in a situation where you're saying to someone, you know, they've come to you, they want a new app on their phone, or they want to use a new piece of software or whatever it is, do a new activity, and they come to you and you say, well, actually, you know, by the letter of the law, you are not required to undertake a DPIA here because this is not high risk processing. So then say, but I still think we should do one to try and get to the bottom of this. It's a very hard sell. You know, most people will at that point go, well, if I don't have to do it, I'm not going to do it. Absolutely switch off. You know, there's no interest. And then beyond that, and this is something I really want to talk about, because I spotted David's comment in the chat, and I'll get to it in just a second, but, you know, saying actually, beyond a DPIA not being mandatory, actually, I think a DPIA would be overkill in this instance, but I still think we should do some type of risk assessment on this. And if you're dealing with someone who doesn't really, you know, isn't confident with it, you will have lost them completely. Because most of the time, the DPIA is the only type of risk assessment from a privacy perspective anyway that the layman is familiar with. And this is where it's one of the things I know you wanted to talk about a little bit. And I thought I may as well raise it now, because I say David puts a comment in the chat in relation to the PrivTech point previously, which was David saying, we're a global corporate and use OneTrust globally for PIA and DPIA and see these as different. We also do a reasonably detailed legitimate interest assessment if selected as the lawful processing mechanism. And funnily enough, as we were off air, Dave, you wanted to talk about potentially the difference between what a PIA and DPIA might be, didn't you?
For sure, because again, you could look at it in a strict sense that if you complete a DPIA, then all you're doing is looking at whatever you're assessing, maybe a new project, and seeing how what you're trying to deliver meets the requirements of the GDPR. Or data protection laws, because your template takes you through what you're doing, why you're doing it, what's the security, what, how are you addressing the principles, that kind of thing. How do you give effect to rights? So in essence, you're assessing it against the data protection framework to how does what you're trying to do meet the requirements of the law in that sense. But that doesn't necessarily mean that by completing a data protection impact assessment, does that necessarily mean that it also addresses privacy? Well, it will do in some circumstances. I'm not saying it's completely void of any kind of privacy concepts, but if you kind of split a DPIA as a data protection impact assessment from a privacy impact assessment, it could indicate, and it might be just rather a bit of a moot point, but it would indicate that you could have a system set up where you're looking at a project. Does it comply with data protection? We run it through a data protection impact assessment. Let's say we've identified that the system doesn't do role-based access controls particularly well, but it can set some of them. And then you put mitigating measures around that to reduce the risk and to mitigate the risks, and or we accept the risk so long as it's not deemed to be high risk processing. That doesn't necessarily itself mean that you're taking a privacy centric approach, and whether you then have, and it doesn't necessarily of itself also mean that it hasn't got an impact on somebody's privacy. And that's where I tend to try to split the two, in the fact that the DPIA, it will help you comply with the law, but it's not necessarily focused on does this activity still fundamentally have an impact on somebody's privacy.
Well, that's really interesting. Also, just quickly on this, Lawrence saying that in his view, you know, the option is really to either go, you know, DPIA everything, cast a wide net, and then you've got a high amount of instances where it's overkill, but at least you can be sure to have captured everything. Or if you're more willing to take a bit of a gamble, then, you know, I suppose you could just do the high risk ones, but then you might be taking on more risk. I'm just going to catch up on the rest of your comments now, everyone. But just before we go on, I wanted to come back to your point there, Dave, which is, you know, talking about really what we're trying to achieve here and talking about impact, because one of the things I see a lot when I'm helping a customer through a DPIA is we get to the end of it, we get to a risk assessment section, and the customer's looked at it and all of the risks that they've outlined are risks to the business, compliance risks. Oh, well, we could suffer reputational damage if this went wrong. Oh, well, we could be in for a fine from the regulator if we got this wrong. And while I obviously understand where that comes from, I do often think to myself, you know, well, surely, you know, the real issue here isn't that the business suffers reputational damage. You know, if a business suffers reputational damage, that's because something has happened and it has had an impact on someone. And that's where your risk is, really. But then it's semantics, really. It's a question of optics, right? But I do see a lot of that. So I suppose defining scope in that sense, but also defining your objective from the outset is going to be vital, right?
No, for sure, for sure. So you're right to have a look at the impacts and what the impact's going to have. Because another point that I often find when people are completing data protection impact assessments, there's a section on there that says, well, how does what you're doing, kind of in essence is this, how does what you're doing give effect to individual rights? And a lot of the time I see, well, we've got a policy on subject access requests, we're covered, that kind of thing, which to me is a rather kind of loose answer, because it's not actually explaining or detailing whether the system that you're using has a quick and efficient way to give you access to the data under subject access request, or whether the system enables you to erase somebody's data in line with an erasure request if it's upheld, and that kind of thing. Just saying you've got a policy doesn't necessarily say that the system will give effect to it in a quick and easy way in that sense, and that would then impact somebody's fundamental rights of saying, I want erasure if it's no longer used, I want access to my data, but you prohibit that because the system's not designed to do that kind of thing. When you get to the rights section of the DPIA, you really need to be thinking, well, does this help us in any way? Is this going to slow us down? Is this going to be problematic? Because like I say, I find it far too often that people just refer to, well, we've got an internal policy that will deal with that, which is fine, because a policy should do what a policy is designed to do, which will give effect to the rights once it's been submitted. But if the system is holding you up because you can't access the data or because you can't give effect to a request, then the policy alone is irrelevant.
Yeah, No, absolutely. Absolutely. I've just had a chance to catch up on all of your comments, those who are with us live here, and thank you so much for your contributions. A couple of bits from David again, just re what we were discussing in terms of their structure. And David, the structure you're describing there is what I've also seen applied. And I do think it works. I think it's a good way of doing it. But essentially, David's saying that they use the PIA as effectively, you were talking before, David, about your stage one, stage two.
Yeah.
Well, instead of it just being a checklist, I don't want to put words in your mouth, David, but from what I've seen, the way to do it would be your stage one isn't a checklist. It is its own smaller risk assessment, its own first stage risk assessment, where subsequently, off the back of that, you may then be asked, the right questions to lead you towards whether a DPIA is required or not. But the benefit of doing your stage one PIA is that there is already some form of risk assessment there. And if more a DPIA is needed, then you can obviously carry that information through with you, any risks through with you. And that's where something, like Privacy Tech has a real value in theory, because you can, if you can calibrate it in such a way, it's going to work particularly well, which is, a really great way of looking at it. Just to cover off Michelle's question about introducing a new payroll system, new contractor biometric clocking in system, and asking whether we think a DPIA would be needed, even though there's resistance from the business, I would say absolutely yes. Because you're talking about biometrics there, you're talking about effectively monitoring people, right? At least they're coming and going. You're tracking their clocking in, clocking out using biometric information. There's a lot going on there. And I said, absolutely. I'm surprised that I suppose it depends on the scale of it, but I'm surprised that doesn't meet a mandatory condition. Oh, it might do, to be fair. That wasn't your question, Michelle, was it? It was, how do you get buy-in, I suppose. Any thoughts on that, Dave? I don't know if you read the comment yourself, but.
I would have said, if you're doing biometrics, especially when you're clocking in, clocking out, it's a work issue. So it's not like you could possibly do it under consent either, if you're looking at a lawful basis for processing. You'll need a lawful basis for processing because it's scanner, because it's biometrics. And by the very fact that it's going to be innovative technology, because fingerprinting, facial recognition, that kind of stuff is quite innovative technology, I would have been saying that you're squarely in a bracket of doing a DPIA.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I agree with what David's saying in response, which is that it could be seen as sort of disproportionate processing of special category information. So you would want to be absolutely sure with that. I might be thinking of a European jurisdiction, but I have a feeling that no, it can't be. For some reason, I thought you weren't allowed to use biometrics for clocking in, clocking out anymore.
Well, but I don't know if you, yeah, but
maybe
don't
that's
forget.
Somewhere in Europe.
Don't forget schools using biometric information for paying for school dinners, because they don't do cash anymore and that kind of stuff. You use your fingerprint to, well, some schools do, use your fingerprint to basically deduct your dinner money from your dinner account.
Yes. Sorry, I was just trying to keep up with comments. But yes, I do remember that. There was a bit of a controversy over that, I think, at the time, in terms of schools looking to introduce that sort of thing. And obviously, certain parents don't have an issue with it. Certain parents really taking offence to it, as understandably so.
For sure.
It's an entirely separate conversation of the increasing, encroachment of biometrics into the everyday. And I'm sure we'll talk about it more as we go forward. Just last week, we were talking about Southern Co-op stores deploying facial recognition cameras to deter those who have previously been caught shoplifting, or they suspect might have been shoplifting. So it's an increasingly relevant topic, but it's a particularly interesting one because, to my mind, in terms of Lawrence is saying that they've been doing that for at least 7 or 8 years, shows how up to speed we are, Dave, in terms of the schools thing. But to my mind, I'm maybe rose-tinted specs here, and I'm perfectly happy to have that highlighted, but if a customer came to me and said, we're looking at doing biometrics for anything, then I'd be insisting on a full DPIA. And I find it, I completely understand why there's going to be pushback, because there's always pushback in like 90% of businesses. Well, actually, maybe not, but there's quite often pushback
for
DPIAs.
And this is kind of, again, looking at I accept it's probably a bit more of a moot point. Is there strictly a difference between a DPIA and a privacy impact assessment? So a DPIA with a fingerprint scanning, you could say, well, you can do it as long as you're legal and you make sure you meet the requirements of the GDPR in that sense, for those here in the UK or the UK GDPR. But from a privacy point, you could be going, well, is it actually necessary from a privacy point? But the two then come back and merge, because a DPIA, as you know, is assessing necessity and proportionality of what you're trying to do. So there is a lot of overlap between a PIA and a DPIA, if you think about it, in that sense. But it's always a good moot point to kind of look at and discuss, I believe, anyway. But just on that, I'm not sure if you're aware that when we're looking at privacy and privacy matters, it goes a lot further back than DPIAs and PIAs and that kind of thing. I was kind of through my master's degree, when I was reading loads of stuff, when I was preparing for this, I remembered I'd read something, so I dug it back out, and there was what they call a fair information practice principles that were developed out of a 1973 report, believe it or not. That was from the United States Department of Housing, Education and Welfare. And a lot of their recommendations are what DPIAs do. So you're looking at things like, it recommends users are informed how the data is going to be used, that there's an opportunity to correct the data, that you need consent if there's going to be any secondary use of their information, that the companies that are processing this, their information needs to be transparent about their practices, needs to set limits on what they gather and process, need to start thinking about data retention and how long you hold this information for, and backing all of that by appropriate security. And those were principles that were set back in 1973 by this by the Department of Education, Housing and Welfare in the US. So the concepts have been around for a long time within the privacy field, and then slowly trickle through to where we are now with DPIA. So I think it's all a really, really interesting kind of topic and discussion around those areas.
It is indeed. Sorry, I'm at a risk of getting sort of baited into talking about biometrics more, because Lawrence is making some really interesting points in the chat. I really want to keep talking about that, but I feel like we'll spend the rest of our time talking biometrics. But I agree with you that part of the issue is where we're effectively using biometrics for something so in theory trivial as clocking in. And then there's an argument to say, well, is it that much of an issue because it's just a fingerprint and all you're doing is clocking in? But again, that's kind of part of the whole
just on that point. I know we've spoken before about things like biometrics and that kind of stuff and genetics. But if that information was taken, you can't actually get it back. It's not like your credit card details were taken and you could just change your credit card details. You know what I mean? If you fundamentally...
Well, yes.
You know, if you fundamentally lost your biometric information and somebody could use that negatively to against you for whatever reason, then it's not like you can kind of go, well, I'll just reset my fingerprint.
I do think there's an interesting broader point on this in terms of the public perception of a lot of this. I mean, obviously, none of us here really are necessarily the public with a capital P, because we're all privacy or security, you know, data protection people around this proverbial table or Teams call, as it may be. But I'm interested because you do sometimes get people really sort of, you hear these stories about people kicking off about, you know, facial recognition cameras, etc. But, you know, most of us now have an iPhone that does thumbprints and facial recognition unlocking.
We've normalized
a standard. And, you know, I don't necessarily have a particularly cogent point here, but the whole thing around the public perception of a lot of these things, I do find fascinating.
Well, I think it's
just to see how it progresses.
Yeah, to me, and I'm happy to be to be told otherwise on it, but to me, I think it's a psychological thing, because the tech in your pocket does exactly what everybody else is doing. So there's kind of an apathy towards it, because it's a case of, well, yeah, if I can use my fingerprint, why not? I use it to access my bank. I use it to access my phone. You know what I mean? And we're now used to facial recognition and biometrics being used when we're flying in and out the country on biometric tagged passports and that kind of thing. So it's over time, technology's kind of normalized it. So it's, you kind of get to the point of, well, I get that, but why wouldn't we do it?
Yeah, no, for sure. Just to bring it back around a little bit, because, I mean, we are supposed to be talking DPIAs. Lawrence makes a good point here, which is, you know, part of the issue, if you don't if you adopt a process, so to come back to what we were talking about previously, where we're saying that, you know, in theory it is possible and even acceptable, albeit potentially problematic, to have a setup whereby you have essentially a two-stage process of, do you need to do one, yes or no? And if it's no, then you nip it in the bud and nothing happens, or at least that's your worst nightmare, apparently, Dave. But you know, that two-stage process, part of the problem behind that is, if you know you don't undertake that in the first place, it then becomes very difficult for you to follow up subsequently and monitor the evolution of the risk associated with it in due course. And you know, because I've had this in customers' businesses where I've looked at something and gone, right, well, based on what you've told me, I think the risk is this. Based on that, we don't really need to implement any further mitigations. Off you go. You can have whatever it is. And through the grapevine, within a couple of weeks, I'm hearing that they've completely changed what they're doing with, you know, the piece of kit that they've gotten approval for. And all of a sudden, the risk profile has completely changed. Now, fortunately, if you've got a DPI in place, then you can work around that. But if you've not assessed it to begin with, it all of a sudden becomes very difficult, right?
Well, that's just kind of documenting, in essence, your risk assessment, your thought process for accountability purposes. And then being able to track and maintain that, make sure that if things fundamentally change, that it's reassessed. Whether you do that through a DPIA or whether you do that through some other form of risk assessment, I guess is open choice, on with the only mandatory bit being, if it's high risk, then you really should be doing a DPIA, because that's where the obligation sits. But you should be documenting it, you should be managing it, it should be the governance framework around that, and the to help make sure that when things are approved, that things are approved and things remain in line with that approval process, and anything that might change or adapt that is then raised as a query and dealt with accordingly, and still documented as to whether it needs any additional work. I think what we need to be careful of, though, is making sure that if we're looking at DPIAs and risk assessments, is there a need to be flexible? Because we've often seen with the data protection reforms that the government's often spouted on about being a bit slow and a bit cumbersome and all that kind of stuff, and fairer turning it all into a tick box. Is it flexible enough to kind of go under certain circumstances, we need to assess to this level from a risk assessment point, or, well, definitely from a risk assessment point, not necessarily DPIA in itself, if you're only looking at high risk, where we started earlier with the conversation. But if you're doing a DPIA over everything, or you're doing some other form of risk assessment, should the risk assessment not reflect the risk and therefore be a bit more fluid to avoid this kind of DPs just to block it, or to avoid this one, it's just red tape and restricting things in that sense? If you're only assessing, it's a very basic setup that we're looking at assessing, should the risk assessment behind that not reflect that, instead of expecting kind of a golden hoop kind of approach?
Yeah, that's a really good point, Dave. I think one of my big frustrations, actually, if I may borrow your soapbox for just a minute, is that 90% of the time when I get that whole, oh, but the DPI slows things down, it's a blocker, whatever, the issue isn't with the risk assessment. The issue is because the person who's meant to be undertaking the DPIA doesn't understand the product in and of itself in the first place. Now, listen, I'm not trying to shift blame or point fingers, but I can't help but get frustrated when the part that is slowing down the DPIA process isn't anything to do with, you know, privacy impact, with risk assessment, etc. It's someone who, listen, and again, I'm painting with a very, very, very broad brush, I appreciate, but someone who maybe wants a specific piece of software, a specific process implementing, and it's not been thought through properly in the first place, you know, and they bring this to you and go, this is what I want to do. And you go, okay, cool. Well, what about this aspect? And they go, well, we've not decided on that yet. And you sort of go, well, A, you know, this clearly demonstrates the value in having this risk assessment, because you hadn't considered this particular part of your process up until now. So that's one thing. But also, you know, how you can't then put the onus back on us as privacy people, and apportion the blame to us for slowing down the process if you've not finalized it yet. Now, I appreciate some of you might say, well, Ol, surely, you know, if you're doing these DPIAs well, you're doing them an early stage in the process, and there are going to be a lot of unanswered questions, because then, and this is something you wanted to talk about, Dave, if you're doing it in that sense, you're really, really on track to be doing data protection by design by default, using a DPIA as part of the process. And I do appreciate that. But there has to be a measure whereby we're at least in a position where that question is not a problematic one, where I'm saying, well, look, I, you know, what are you going to do here? And that question isn't all of a sudden, you know, oh, we've never considered that. We'd never thought of that. This is really going to slow us down. It's a, yeah, we thought that might be an issue. We're going to go away and find a solution to it. I mean, I don't know if that just comes off slightly bitter, Dave, but it is something that I wanted to raise at this juncture.
No, for sure. And I think some of it, I mean, it goes back to, I've had various different roles in auditing, and I don't think I stepped back quick enough, so I ended up having to work with health and safety for a while and auditing health and safety and that kind of thing. And part of the audit training for health and safety, and the reason why the team was changed at that point was because the external consultant for the organisation came in and said, well, were you looking at health and safety and things? Do you do risk assessments? And they went, yes. And they went, well, have you trained people to do risk assessments? And they went, no. So the question from the consultant at that point was, well, what's the value in your risk assessments if you're not training people to identify risks and know how to mitigate risks? So I think the kind of two bits are kind of linked in the sense that some people don't understand the process, and is that just a training issue? And is it just simply a training issue for those you're expecting to complete a DPIA hasn't had appropriate training in how to identify and mitigate risks? Because let's be fair, my stance on risk is it's subjective, right? So you may determine something to be greater or lesser risk than somebody else. So we need this kind of objectivity to do in risk assessments. And does anybody actually train those who are expected to complete risk assessments to consider it in that light?
It's incredibly difficult, because the problem is that all of a sudden you end up in a situation where it's almost adversarial, and that was never the intention, and actually it becomes adversarial, and that is inherently more problematic. And then where do you go from there? Jane says, I find that I am often expected to complete most of the assessment and identify the risks. You know, I think we can probably all relate to that. And Janice also sort of echoing the fact that it can be difficult to get the process out of people. I hear what Ben's saying, and I completely agree, which is that, you know, sometimes we'll be inclined to facilitate DPIs by converting conversations into the starting point of a written document. But then trying to say that it's for the system/process owner to complete becomes a barrier. And that is difficult. And this is kind of where I'm coming from. And this is almost more of just a, you know, airing a grievance, quite frankly, but is when you say to someone, okay, well, a good place to start with this is, have you got any project documentation? Have you got a process flow? Have you got a map? Have you got any sort of technical documentation? And you just get back the answer, no, we haven't got any of that.
Mm-hmm.
And you sort of go, well, listen, your project's off to a rocky start if you haven't got any of that, because I would expect to see that sort of thing purely from a, like, not even from a privacy point of view. I would expect to see that from a project management point of view. Now, sure, you're not going to have that level of documentation for everything. There are going to be things that we end up risk assessing which are, you know, way, way below that threshold, that don't necessitate process flows, maps, technical documentation, whatever. But when that's not in place for something more significant, that's where, well, first of all, the alarm bells go off. But secondly, it can be quite frustrating, I find. And Ben is spot on. Again, the other issue is trying to maintain your independence to be able to give feedback on the document. And that is, I mean, we've not touched on it, but we probably should have done, and we're running out of time, but we can still do a couple of minutes. All of a sudden, if you're helping out on something, that really starts to call into question your independence a little bit, because if you're being expected to write up this review and then risk assess it and then approve the risk assessment potentially, because, you know, we see that in some businesses where there's not necessarily the resource, it's extremely difficult.
It's a very valid point about marking your own homework, and I do just want to kind of just reflect on the point you've just mentioned there a second ago, whether any DPOs are expected to sign off the DPIA before the activity can go ahead, or sign it off as, well, we can't do this unless you sign it off as a DPO.
Yes, absolutely, Dave. That old chestnut, the whole, we need you to approve this, and you're sat there going, well, listen, I'll approve the risk assessment, but I'm not approving the activity behind it or the product behind it.
I often tell them that I don't have that kind of power. I'm happy to sign it, so I've read it, and I'm happy to sign it to say that I've looked through it, I've assisted if I've assisted, that I feel the relevant privacy points have been identified, the relevant DP risks have been mitigated, that kind of thing. But signing it off as approval, as saying we can go ahead because the DPO is happy, just seems like somebody's trying to give me more power than I'm entitled to.
My particular wording is that I approve the DPIA and nothing else. Because otherwise, Michael mentions they have a DPIA panel that approves DPIAs. Nothing can move forward until the sign off. I feel like we've talked about this before, Michael, and you've mentioned that. And that's a really, really good idea to have an actual, spread that accountability around effectively a little bit and not have that single point of failure.
It's not just necessarily a single point of failure for me. The bit that I'm really interested in is what Michael just mentioned there, is because I've had the discussion with a couple of clients before, which is if you delegate authority to complete, let's say this came up in the chat, I think you mentioned previously about process owners or somebody, system owners or process owners being the individuals responsible for completing the DPIA and that kind of stuff. But let's say you've identified some key risks and that individual said, well, we can accept this risk, we can mitigate that risk. Have they actually got the authority to accept that risk? If you're talking about corporate risk appetite, then who within the organization's got that ability to do that? It shouldn't be the DPO, because we've just discussed that point, but who accepts that risk? And I quite like the idea that you might have delegated the authority down to a panel that between them know where their kind of authority sits. Anything outside that then lifts to a higher body to make a determination on some of the key points that are within that. Because it comes down to if you say, yes, we're going ahead with this DPIA, in essence, you're kind of going, we accept the fact that we've mitigated, we accept the residual risks, whatever the residual risks may be, and we're going to go and plow ahead. But that doesn't necessarily mean that acceptance of that risk is necessarily within the corporate risk appetite.
I think the thing for me about having the panel that I like is the element of committee. So within that panel sits somebody from clinical, so somebody from legal, somebody like myself from IG, information security. So you identify far more risks than you would if it was simply a singular DPO, because it's the other risks involved within the process, not just those around security, certainly within a healthcare environment like where we work. And the other thing is, there is advisories from part of the compliance team into those DPIAs about what is expected before it's even submitted to the panel, but ultimately it's the panel that will reject or sign off.
I think it's a great setup. I've not come across that, so thank you for much raising it, but I think it's a great idea. It may not reflect and work for every organisation, depending on the size, nature, scope, the types of processing and so on and so forth. But if it fits your organisation and works well, I think it's a great idea, because, like I say, it comes back to me as well. Who's accepting the risk? I was talking to a client yesterday, and it's only a decent sized charity, and all their DPIAs are signed off by the chief exec, because she's determined that she's the only one in the organisation that can accept the risk.
Fair enough, I suppose.
So, interesting point.
Yeah, very interesting. There's plenty more to get into. As per usual, we've sort of done that thing again where we really sort of find our stride with sort of 10 minutes to go, Dave, which is pretty typical of us. There seems to be some more support for the panel. People are liking that in terms of signing off on risk assessments. Again, I think the consensus seems to be broadly the same, which is, we're all okay to approve the process, to approve the assessment that it has been done, and we can see that it's been done and it's been done to an appropriate standard. But in terms of the actual content of that, the subject matter of it and the residual risk that comes out of it, as Ben says, that's something which we're not entitled to sign off on, or we shouldn't be asked to sign off on. It's not really our place to do that. That's probably, to be honest with you, I say we were already over by a couple of minutes. That's probably going to be it. Dave, have you got any closing thoughts for us at all on any of this? I mean, there's been loads of participation in the chat. Has anyone done a DPIA for telephone recording systems with customer services from Lawrence? Yes. Zara's done one literally this week. I was reviewing it for her.
And I knew we should have had her on. We'll have to get Zara on one day.
Listen, I've been trying my best. I'll try and anonymize a copy and flick it over to Lawrence for reference. Any thoughts from you, Dave, before we close?
Kind of only really coming back to the start of are we doing DPIAs properly is to understand, and this isn't coming from the point I don't think anybody understands it, but just to understand how you do risk assessments, understand how you assess risk within the organisation, whether that's by DPIA or otherwise in that sense, and just make sure it's robust enough captures what you need to capture. So, for example, I think all within an information risk policy to set out how you manage information risks and monitor compliance around those risks, because one of the bits we haven't touched on is how often do you find a DPIA mitigates the risks, but you never see those actions completed and never see them through. It's kind of right, we've done our bit, now the light switch has been flicked, we've got our DPIA, the DPO or whoever's in charge has signed it off, we've identified the mitigating steps, but when you review them from a point of review, you never see any evidence to say that the steps have been completed.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Do you know what? It is weird.
Say never's maybe a bit too much, but yeah. We sometimes find that they've never been completed.
Yeah, fair enough. Do you know what? It's absolutely bizarre. Everyone, well, not everyone, but there's a large number of people here asking for a DPIA on a phone recording system. And I happen to have looked at two in the last week. It's very odd how these things come around. You know, I was saying this to Zara the other day. It always seems to be everyone's working on similar things at the same time. I wonder why that happens. Maybe it's just confirmation bias. Who knows? Anyway, on that note, I think we've probably done our time. I'll tell you what, everyone who is here and wants a copy of that, let me go and I'll try and produce you all a nice anonymized copy. Although I will point out that the two that I've seen have slightly different purposes. So I'll try and fold some of that in. For you all. I'm not putting the burden on Zara. She's already got plenty on her plate. Bless her. Anyway, on that note, Dave, thank you very much for your time this afternoon. Lovely to have a chat about this topic again. Maybe scope for a third in future, although we might not leave it an entire year before we do a follow-up this time.
We've got an annual program of DPIAs.
Yes. We are back next week with an episode of GDPR Radio, so our standard open surgery type conversation. And then there is also our big PCIDSS version 4 chat on the horizon. So keep an eye out for that. That's going to be particularly interesting. And between then and now, we hope you all have a lovely weekend and hope to catch up with you all soon. Thanks for attending.
Thank you now. Bye-bye. Mm-hmm.